This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, Episode 10. Alternative finance is a huge and growing sector. It's also one that is increasingly complex, and one where the rules vary from country to country. I thought it would be very useful for the fintech community at large to do a big picture, 3,000 feet overview of the sector, and I'm very excited to present such a show. Who better than AltFi, who are the premier authorities in London on this sector, running highly praised events, award dinners, comment, research, and much more, to talk to us about this. To me, the existence of groups like AltFi is all part of the maturing of the London fintech scene. London's financial services sector, and consequent fintech sector, is vast in breadth and increasingly in depth. To drill down below the 30,000 feet level, one needs increasing speciation. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Rupert Taylor, who heads AltFi's data division. This sounds very prosaic, perhaps, but if you consider the importance of, say, the FTSE All-Share Index, you will appreciate how fundamental such plumbing is to the development of a marketplace. Imagine if you couldn't judge your investment manager against any indices. How would you judge him? Well, right now, the alternative finance industry is perhaps rather at that stage, and there's a hardcore, essential job to be done creating some indices and the like. Rupert is well positioned to provide context for the alternative finance sector. With over a dozen years of investment banking experience covering Cazenove's, Lehman's and Nomura, he's got a real financial services background, initially in institutional equities before moving into principal trading. As well as being chief executive of AltFi Data, Rupert also runs Regenesis, a bioenergy business. So there's plenty to talk about, and let's get on with the show. Hi, Rupert. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Many thanks for having me on the show. I've always disliked the way that insiders in any industry hide behind jargon, and so I'm really excited to have the opportunity to explain and help people understand, certainly what we understand, by the various different terminologies of this emerging sector.
Excellent. I share your dislike for jargon. So, Rupert, there's obviously quite a story contained in all the above, which has led you to where you are here and now talking to me. So how did this all start?
Well, I partnered with a guy called David Stevenson, who was one of the first journalists to get involved writing about the sector. Even today, frankly, there's not a lot of comment in the mainstream press about what is an increasingly interesting and disruptive space. But David's been writing about the space for many years, and he became interested in the idea of turning his views into some sort of a brand and indeed a business which would create content around the sector. I was increasingly feeling like my career in investment banking had sort of run its course in terms of the extent to which it was satisfying me. And I met with David. I was introduced through actually a friend who's also a participant in the industry. And we got very excited about the possibility of organizing conferences. And then most excitingly from my perspective, the idea that this was an industry spitting out all sorts of bits of interesting data, but nobody was in any way collecting or aggregating that data.
Great. So let's come back to the data point later, because as I said, and as we were just talking about before, when I first heard about AltFi data, that sounded very prosaic. And someone has a background in computer science, when people say data, I think of zeros and ones and don't get as excited as maybe you guys were. But as I mentioned in the preamble, there's a lot more to it than data. There's information and knowledge and all that kind of stuff. Backtracking a little bit, I mentioned that you've got a background in Lehman's and Nomura, which for all of those with a background in FS, obviously involves a little bit of an interesting story. Where were you in the whole saga of 2008? I remember 2008 because everyone thought the world was going to end.
Yeah, and I guess as an employee of Lehman, when it went bust,
it did end for you.
Yeah, but actually, it was a really good time in my career. I mean, it was a hugely naive and stupid move of me to leave a very stable and well-positioned investment bank like Cazenove and go to Lehman, which, as it turned out, was anything but stable and well-positioned. And I'd only been there a little bit more than 12 months when it all fell apart. But, you know, I was young and I was very much kind of on the upswing in terms of my career. And so I think before the end of the day that Lehman went bust, I was doing interviews and I was offered various jobs. And actually, that was the beginning, really, of my career moving away from sales towards principal trading, i.e. towards investment. And that was very much a move I'd wanted to make. And that was a move which allowed me to broaden my skill set. So, yeah, it was a disastrous decision to move to Lehman. But all in all, the whole event is not something I regret. And equally, I think it's important in terms of how it's shaped my perspective on banking and banking's role in society and the right way to do it and less good ways to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting about the narratives. I mean, I've got a couple of teenage daughters, so I'm very aware of this. And a lot of the educational narrative is still the kind of narrative of when I was a kid at school, which was of linear progress. You try and get good exam results. You get into a good company. You'd move move up the ladder, you'd be there for life. It was all some kind of stable, straight line. But there's very few people to whom that happens. And as you say, you know, there's ups and downs and all kind of things. But just from a bit more of a sort of an older, maturer perspective, you know, one day always leads to the next. And what you can do on the next day depends on all the experiences you've had before. And as I mentioned before on the show many times, in terms of the people I've met on the scene that I've found that have got something really hardcore and really valuable, there's some people that know the industry very well. You know, I'm not against tech in the slightest bit, but if you're really good at tech, you could do with partnering up with somebody who's really good at financial services and vice versa. So moving on to the 3,000 feet guide to alternative finance, which I'm certainly interested in hearing myself because it's very hard to get an overview. How does alternative finance break down? If you're going to draw me an organogram of the alternative finance at the top, what comes below that?
It's an excellent question. And to be honest, I don't think anyone is totally in agreement on this yet. But certainly at AltFi, we have views as to how we break it down. So broadly, we would split alternative finance into peer-to-peer lending, which is effectively debt, and crowdfunding, which we view as being equity.
Just stopping there because it's an easy point for folks to miss and it always slightly confuses me before my brain clicks in. Coming back to the question of vocabulary, a lot of this has kind of grown up, and in the way that towns grow up and become cities, everything's kind of in the wrong place. And these historic terms like peer-to-peer, which from a computer science thing means one thing to me, suddenly gets associated with equity or debt or vice versa. So really, alternative finance, you can split it down into debt and equity. For historic reasons, they have got particular names, which tends to be peer-to-peer, meaning debt, and crowdfunding on the equity.
Yeah, not everyone would agree with me on that. Some people think crowdfunding covers debt, but for me, it's much simpler. The way to distinguish is between debt and equity, because that is the most fundamental difference. The differences in the nature of the asset classes and the type of risk the investor's taking are the single biggest distinctions. So let's distinguish along those lines.
And then how does the debt side split down?
So within peer-to-peer, i.e. the lending side, there are three broad sectors. So there is SME lending. So that's lending to small and medium-sized companies. There is consumer lending, which is lending to other human beings, other people in the street. And then there is invoice factoring.
And then just on invoice factoring, because every time I meet an invoice factoring company, I have to rack my brains to quite remember what factoring is all about. Factoring is that in the future, when people are paying me $1 million to appear on my show, I send them an invoice and months later they haven't paid me. And I go along and someone else pays me less than 100 cents on the dollar for my invoice.
Yeah, so what
is that basically it?
That's basically it. What you'd probably do in anticipation of me not paying you.
Yeah.
Before I'd even turned up on the show, you'd say, look, I've invoiced this chap. I'm a bad example. I've invoiced this person who's an excellent credit.
Yeah.
More likely, I've invoiced this multinational company.
Yeah.
So the example I'd like to use is a pudding manufacturing company selling puddings to a supermarket.
Right.
Okay, it's a small startup, pudding manufacturer, makes very tasty puddings, and it's now selling to Tesco. Okay. Obviously, cash flow is tough for a small company. But Tesco's a great credit. So it goes to the bank and says, look, I've got this agreement with Tesco. I've just delivered them X 100,000 puddings. Can you lend me money against that invoice? Now, there's a subtlety, which is whether or not the lender of the money has the invoice transferred to his name so that the supermarket ends up paying directly to the bank, or whether the bank just sees that invoice to give him confidence that the pudding company will end up paying him back. There's a subtle distinction there, but basically both forms are part of invoice factoring.
And not being politically correct, essentially, this is because big co's, we mentioned some supermarkets, but a lot of them like to screw, putting it unpolitically correct, small co's. And I'm old enough to remember when the Conservative government, before the last set of Labour governments was in, and they were going to do some bill about it, and Heseltine, a big company person, put his foot through the boat and stop that one going ahead. There was going to be some legislation that says all big co's must play small co's within 60 days or something like that by law, and that never happened, and therefore there's still this market anomaly or market problem. And coming back to the alternative finance, the invoice trading or factoring or the million stuff around invoice is actually to help people deal with that issue.
Absolutely, and whilst it's an area the banks have to some extent retreated from since the crisis, where they still participate, they participate at very aggressive rates, very expensive rates,
is the better way to put it. So you doubly lose money. So big supermarket, just to choose a random example, they somewhat screw you by not really paying you on time. Then you trade your invoice and some bank on that big company that screws you as well. So before you know it, you've got not a lot left.
Essentially.
Okay,
essentially.
So that's very interesting because I've never quite really got my head around why there are 1,000,001 invoice companies out there. So that's going down the debt side of it. And then what's on the equity side or the crowdfunding side?
So on the equity side, there is equity crowdfunding, which is where individuals are buying a small equity stake in normally a relatively small business. But then the crowdfunding side is slightly confused by the presence of reward funding.
Okay.
So reward funding is the Kickstarter type model. It's a model which is becoming quite big in the media world. I'm actually involved with a business called Pledge Music, which is a reward funding type model where fans finance the album or the next piece of work of their favoured band. So reward funding is essentially where investors aren't taking an equity stake, but they are pledging some money, and in return, they will get the product once it's been made.
Right.
Now, it could be they get more than just the product.
Yeah.
It could be they get a special edition of the product, or a goodie bag, or an interview with the chief exec, or dinner with the chief exec. Essentially, the business is swapping stuff that it can give for money stroke advanced sales of its product.
And then, without getting too far below the 3,000 feet level, we mentioned that equity and the debt are the big categories, but then there's also all sorts of hybrid instruments start cropping up, debt with equity characteristics, equity with debt characteristics, and that whole FS investment banking gamut.
Yes, I guess really this is going on the crowdfunding side, where crowdfunding sites are beginning to move into mini bonds, and there's also been examples of convertible equity. That's not a convertible bond, that's an instrument that converts into equity at a later date. So there is some innovation on that side. Yes, there is some innovation on that side.
I did read an article, so anyone who's interested in mini bonds, if they Google mini bonds, Rupert Taylor, Rupert wrote a very interesting article, nice meaty content.
This is an interesting area on the basis that obviously we're huge supporters of financial innovation, but we're also very keen to see that the investor is investing in sound investments.
Exactly. Well, let's just stop there because that's an important point. So we've come down from the 3,000 feet. We've divided it into two subcategories and then the various subcategories within the subcategories. And speciation and finding niches will continue, and complexity, as it does in all industries. But coming right back to the top, is it true to say that the essence of alternative finance is... this sounds really stupid, as most of my insights generally do, is basically finance not provided by banks directly. Somebody's putting money into the system and someone's taking it out somehow, and the banks are not directly involved in that.
No, I think that is a very good way of defining it. Essentially, it is the process of transferring excess liquidity to those to whom it's excess, who don't need it, to people who do need it and are therefore willing to pay for it. That's what banks do.
Why has it suddenly boomed in the last few years? What are the key factors to you of this?
So for me, the simple answer to that is the internet. Arguably, it's surprising that a lot of things reacted incredibly quickly to the internet. I suppose the reason financial services maybe reacted a bit more slowly is because of the presence of regulation and the complexity of the space. But Zopa, to my mind, invented...
Was it about 2005 or something? Or?
I was going to say 2006.
Quite a while ago.
And essentially, it's all about providing what we've just described, so the transfer of excess liquidity from those who don't need it to those who are willing to pay for it. But it's about doing it at a much better rate for both borrower and saver.
Now, let's just press the pause on that. So what are the reasons that the interweb and companies on the interweb can offer, quote, a much better rate?
Right.
Because that's really interesting, microeconomics.
Okay, so essentially, a huge layer of cost has been removed. Banks, who historically have been the purveyors of transferring liquidity from one place to the other, have an expensive branch network, which I would argue the internet has made redundant. That branch network is filled with staff, who indeed, sadly, are no longer required in this process. And finally, and this is probably more controversial and still up for debate, I would argue that the new peer-to-peer lending industry, in part by using the internet, is lending much more effectively. I is better at pricing credit, is better at taking lending risk. Now, if you add all that up, then if you think of a bank's margin, it's giving savers one rate and it's lending out at another rate, and the rest is its margin. Now, if you remove the fixed cost base that isn't required, and if you move all the labour that's not required, and if you become better at lending, then a huge amount of that margin is there to be shared between both borrower and saver.
Right. So I buy that. That sounds good. So far, so good.
I'm glad you're happy with that.
No, I was just thinking about it. Again, so we just started, the perspective of time, one day leads to another, leads to another. So what is today's solution becomes tomorrow's problem in a way. So what you say is absolutely correct today, but let's fast forward. And as you say, it's booming. There's masses of money flowing in. Maybe you want to say something about the two directions, but just picking the UK, there's retail funds going to flood in because George Osborne is very keen to get retail involvement via ISAs. So you'll be able to stick your ISA money into this peer-to-peer stuff and, for the sake of argument, get 5% rather than 2.5% on your cash. And then separately, there's institutional money flowing in. I saw something saying in America, something like 80% of the funds on these peer-to-peer things are now hedge funds. So you've got retail and wholesale funds flowing in. So again, being sort of older and having no hair, what tends to happen when you've got something which is a great idea today and tons of money flows in is that actually eventually the risk return doesn't become so favourable. And at some point in time, things start going wrong. So I wasn't disagreeing at all with your nice clear analysis of the past and where we are today. I was just more thinking, okay, I wonder how long this lasts.
Excellent question. And throughout my career in financial services, I've many times wished I had a crystal ball. Sadly, I don't. The way I see it is, actually, your question touches on a whole number of issues.
So indeed.
I'm just juggling them in my head.
Just roll a smoke bomb across and open Pandora's box at the same time, and then say, what do you think, Rupert?
But the first way I would try and distill it is by saying that you're now, number one, you're removing leverage. You may be reintroducing leverage. We'll come on to that. But you're putting risk in places where it sits more comfortably. Okay, so the situation we're in at the moment is that lending risk is centered within a small number of banking institutions that have indeed become too big to fail, which has left us in a position where, for the good of the economy, we've all recognized, reluctantly or less reluctantly, that banks have to be rescued by the state. So ultimately, the taxpayer has to carry the can if this all goes wrong. Okay, now what peer-to-peer lending is doing is hugely diversifying the presence of lending risk. It's moving it away from banks, and it's moving it into hands that are happy to have that risk. So kind of this is where the idea that leverage will be reintroduced at some point comes in.
So just pressing pause there for people without an FS background, and there are some who listen to this. This whole point about leverage is fundamental for a number of reasons. From a macroeconomic perspective, a lot of the growth we've seen, certainly since about the 60s or 70s, in Western economies has come by an explosion in basically debt, government debt and bank debt, and excess money has fueled it all. So macroeconomically, it's important. Microeconomically, banks and the government are the only people who can create money. So simplistically, if you look at peer-to-peer lending, a rich chap like you lends to somebody like me who's got to pay school fees, but you put a dollar in or a pound in, and I take a pound out. There's no leverage there. Whereas if you stick your pound in the bank, that probably goes and lends £10 out there.
Very well explained. And so within peer-to-peer lending and within the platforms, there is no leverage. And indeed, if I'm lending to you to pay your school fees, I may be levered behind that, but ultimately, you know, I lend a pound, you get a pound, as you describe. Where this is interesting and where it's changing is that peer-to-peer in the UK has very much been driven by the retail investor, by the consumer. But peer-to-peer in the US, which was invented after the UK, it copied the UK, but has grown very, very quickly, is dominated by institutions. So by, you know, financial services companies, investment houses, pension funds, etc., hedge funds. Increasingly, institutional money is now finding its way into the UK and Europe as well. Now, when they lend a pound on a platform, somebody borrows a pound, but it may be that the pound that the institution is lending is actually only 50p of its own money and 50p of borrowed money.
Okay, so again, just to keep this simple, so in the UK, we're talking about the simplistic thing where we are at the moment, although it is changing. You put a pound in, I take a pound out. In America, where our source is, for example, hedge funds generate their excess returns, another topic entirely, I would argue, by taking excess risk. But basically, they are investing a dollar of their own cash and they've borrowed another dollar from the bank. So the banks aren't actually disappearing from the value chain here. They're just being reduced in the scale of what they're doing.
Correct, but you have introduced enormous diversification because, yes, the bank is lending to the hedge fund, who's then lending to, let's say, Mike to pay his school fees. If the hedge fund goes bust, the hedge fund isn't too big to fail. Nobody cares.
Yes.
So you're putting leverage into the hand of many more. You are definitely diluting the presence of the too big to fail effect.
Yes, I can see, and that's why the government is so keen on it. And in terms of diversifying risk, as you say, you're spreading it around the sector. I think today, no doubt, there's a lot of kind of experienced investors putting their money in. My concern is once everybody's bunging their money in the ISA, there's lots of people who can't assess risk in the first place putting their money in, but that's down the track, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important point to raise. I suppose platforms at the moment are doing a very, very good job of being extremely cautious and sensible. So number one, their lending discipline is very, very strong. They're very careful to only list sensible risks on the platform. Number two, many of them are putting in place structures to protect savers against the first loss. So if something goes wrong, there's often some sort of fund in place to protect savers.
So just pressing pause there, again, just simplistic, are there in essence two basic types, one of which whereby there's the direct thing, as you're saying, you give your money to me via the platform, and another whereby you put your money in a fund and the fund gives it to, say, 100 Mikes and his school fee paying friends?
I guess that's happening in two ways. There was a closed-ended fund listed on the stock market, which investors can buy shares in, effectively put their money into, and it will invest into a range of peer-to-peer assets via a range of peer-to-peer platforms. But the other way it's happening is that you can give your money to the platform or invest your money on the platform. Let's say I invest £10,000. The platform will slice that into 10,000 pieces of £1 for me.
To diversify your risk for you.
Exactly.
And that's really important, I think, going forwards, especially if it's ISAs and that kind of stuff, because those individuals will not have the credit skills. So as you say, and you know, in talking about leverage, and that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that, again, over the last 30 years, financial services have got increasingly bundled and bundled into mega corporates who are doing a million things, and therefore they're doing a million things in a fairly average fashion. And what we're now seeing is a certain degree of unbundling the corporation, and you're getting the credit specialists join these vehicles, and they're like really good at credit.
Exactly.
And the guys who are running these things, they want a bunch of techies to make sure that tech works. They want a bunch of credit folks who are really good at credit and a few businessmen to kind of stick it all together.
Exactly. And I guess the bit I'm missing is that at AltFi Data, you know, we hope to have an exciting role to play in all of this, which is we hope to help people appraise on an independent basis what sort of risk a loan might involve.
Let's come on to that in a minute. But just to continue the 3,000 feet overview, so do you want to talk briefly about the equity side of it? Probably quite a few people are used to the equity crowdfunding thing because lots of their mates come along and say, oh, do you want to invest in my latest business idea?
Yes. I mean, interestingly, it's actually by, if you measure it in monetary terms, it's a much smaller part of the sector at the moment. But yes, arguably people are more familiar with it. To a certain extent, what you're doing is you're democratizing angel investment networks. So historically, wealthy people who were interested in doing this sort of thing would get themselves involved in networks where they would be introduced to many exciting little businesses looking for funding. Again, using the internet, what you're doing is you're giving those businesses exposure to anyone who can be bothered to surf the internet and find a platform which is willing to introduce them to those companies.
Yeah, so you're democratizing and also you're reducing the power of the large entities. So in the past, if you wanted equity, you'd have to either ask a few people you know or go via the stock exchange or AIM or something like that. And recently we've had this famous case of Chapel Downs, the wine manufacturer, who's raised, you can tell me, several million, 2-3 million or something like that, via one of these platforms.
Yeah, and indeed many businesses have raised decent chunks of equity on these platforms. I guess for me, the important thing to consider when it comes to equity crowdfunding is that, you know, yes, there's been a move away from big corporations, big institutions, the stock market, etc. But people shouldn't overlook the fact that those are long-established institutions which are very heavily regulated and which have got very sensible rules and processes in place. And certainly when I look at equity crowdfunding investments, I'm very keen to see that as an equity investor, I'm going to have all the rights that I should expect as an equity investor.
Absolutely. And I'm not involved in the sector, so I can put it more bluntly than that. So all sorts of people ask me to invest in all sorts of things. And frankly, some of them are crap. And I wouldn't invest myself, let alone want my granny to be investing on the one hand. And on the other hand, all this EIS, SEISE stuff that one hears about these days. In the 1990s, there was something called BES, which was another tax efficient way of investing in companies. And of all the chaps that I know invested in BESs in the 90s, the vast majority lost the vast majority of their money. I've still got an investment in a BES and they're still setting on it 20 years later and I can't get my money out. So there's all sorts of cautions around that sector. Moving on to the AltFi Data, which, as I say in the introduction, sounds perhaps prosaic to people, but is absolutely critical. Things like the FTSE All-Share, indices, ways to measure performance are really vital to the maturing of an industry. So how do you see that, Rupert, as the CEO of one of the leading, if not the leading company in the sector?
Thank you, an excellent question. So the first point to make is that it's only when investors can see exactly what they're getting for the risk they're taking that an asset class tends to really take off. So there are many examples of this through history, even, for example, where in an existing asset class, let's say, for example, a stock exchange is created in a new geography, it's only when somebody can tell you what the dividend yield is on that stock exchange, on all the companies listed on that exchange, that anybody's going to be interested in investing. So it gets back to comparing the available return with the risk-free rate so that any sensible investor can take a view of how much return they're getting for how much risk they think they're taking. So we're very keen that this sector should be in a position to articulate exactly that. And indeed, the sector is very keen to work with us. So we're working with all the platforms to aggregate their data to provide those sorts of metrics.
And is this on the debt side or the equity side or both predominantly?
So we have a volume index which focuses on all of these areas. So it's just summing the monetary amounts that are getting matched.
So $3 billion was done this year or whatever.
Exactly. But what we're very keen to build is a returns index. And frankly, this focuses much more on the peer-to-peer side, the debt side, than on the equity side. There have been realizations on the equity side, so there have been equity investments made where there has then been an opportunity to exit at a far higher price. But generally, there haven't been many, and that'll take a long time for those to come to fruition. Whereas on the debt side, people are generating return all the time.
So at a simplistic level, you can take the three largest debt players in the sector and say their average returns this year have been 4%, 5% and 6%.
Exactly.
As a start.
It's important, though, to understand exactly how we're doing that. And that is, we are taking every single loan that these platforms have made, and then we're doing our own analysis of the cash flows to work out after the income, after the coupon, after any defaults, and then net of any recoveries, if there's been a default, what was the actual return to investors.
Okay, so it's a good job that computers exist these days, because you'd require quite a lot of monkeys and typewriters to work that out otherwise.
Exactly. It involves, if not a very large computer, certainly a computer where it's got a decent sized screen so you can read what's going on.
So I don't know whether you've got any sort of statistics off the top of your head, but I've got in my mind that this sector does billions of dollars of business per annum at the moment. I saw some PR-y hype this morning in some article on saying that, oh, someone's forecasting it's going to be 45 billion, which seemed to be a very random number in a few years' time. But anyway, there's billions of dollars of volume at the moment. So what kind of numbers of transactions are you looking to aggregate? Obviously millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions. I mean, hell of a lot there.
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
You pay people to do that kind of thing. Well,
Mr. Microsoft and Mr. Excel and some bigger versions of that are doing those calculations. But yeah, it's in very large numbers. You know, the sector is growing at well over 100%. You know, it's matched billions of pounds worth of loans. But what we're very keen to build is this returns index, because from this returns index, you're going to be able to measure skill.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely critically important, because as institutional investors come into this sector and as ISA type products come into this sector, the investor, particularly the retail investor, is going to need to know how he's doing versus the average.
Yeah.
Is he better doing it himself, or is he better giving his money to a fund manager? Yeah. The reason that's so important is this is a disintermediated industry. Yeah. This is a classic internet disruptive industry, whereby
or re-intermediated industry.
Aha, so you have disintermediated it, but then to a very small extent you're considering re-intermediating bits of it. What I mean by that is you could lend to SMEs or consumers yourself on a platform, and you've totally disintermediated all the other players. Or you could choose to give your money to a fund management business to invest that money. That is, to some small extent, re-intermediation.
Yeah.
Now, that's only a good idea if he can prove to you he's going to do it better than you do it yourself. And for him to do that, he needs a benchmark.
Absolutely. And without getting into something which is a sort of a whole episode topic on its own, if not more, what's your current thinking about how you're going to look at the risk in those, having sat down, whatever it was, 25 years ago and thought about risk from a blank sheet of paper when no one was doing it at the aggregate level in banks? One of the problems of measuring risk is what I always used to think of as a nuclear power station, which is that 49 years in a row, your nuclear power station makes a load of money, and then the 50th year in a row blows up a quarter of the country. That's impossible to measure that kind of risk until you're getting a significant number of default events.
Yes, and to some extent, the joy of what we're doing for us is that there are no risk metrics at the moment.
Yeah.
So actually, I can help just by providing what I view as the purest measure of risk. The purest measure of risk to me is when you actually lose money, permanent loss of capital. Yeah. So at the moment, the way we measure risk is we just look at historic returns. Yeah. We look at what all these loans are delivering. And as I say, after the coupon, factoring in defaults, factoring in recoveries, which bits actually genuinely cost people money.
There's an interesting paradoxical situation here, which is that at the moment, because returns have been high, losses have been low, it's quite hard to measure the risk. But as the risk increases, it'll get easier to measure the risk because there's more risks and more defaults going forward. It's a big data thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly the more events, the bigger the sector gets, the purer your answer becomes. But actually, there's another very interesting factor at play, which is that the sector is very young and growing very quickly. So it has more recently made loans on its books.
Oh, yes, you were telling me about this. This one had passed my mind, yeah.
Yeah, than aged loans. Now, the simple reality, it's a slight oversimplification, but the simple reality is that young loans are less likely to default than old loans. If I've lent you money on a 3-year term, for the first couple of months, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's in month 24 through 36 that you might have a problem.
I think the takeaway from that and all of this stuff, it's a very big, it's a really important, it's a growing sector, it's very complex, and for 99.9 out of 100 listeners, I'd really recommend that rather than trying to do this themselves, they just go to you guys and look at some of this stuff, because you've got lots of background over a decade in investment banking, you guys have got all the data, you're working through all these complexities, and you're producing a nice simple product which gives you a simple metric.
Absolutely, yeah. Most of our information at the moment is freely available. There's a lot of freely available information on the website. But I suppose the other point I would want to make is I would absolutely not discourage people from getting involved in this sector.
No, I didn't mean that. I just meant sort of in terms of actually working out all the data for themselves.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I'd be delighted for them to come to us. But the other point I'd want to make is that this sector is in the process of delivering far better value to the wider economy. And there's an absolutely staggering body of academic work that shows that on a GDP-weighted basis, the unit cost of financial intermediation, so the unit cost of banking, basically, the unit cost of moving excess liquidity to places where it's needed, has not fallen in 100 years. I find that quite staggering.
I'm surprised it hasn't gone up, actually.
Well, there are some metrics which suggest it's gone up. Yeah, so it kind of fell for a bit in the 60s and 70s, maybe with the beginnings of technology. But then it went up again, which would kind of suggest that the technology wasn't used to deliver a better deal. It was just used to do more, for the banks to do more. And actually on some metrics, certainly around 2006, 7, 8, banking was as expensive to the economy as it's ever been. Now, my view is that peer-to-peer lending, crowdfunding, etc., is bringing the reduction in cost that it seems logical that the internet should bring to this industry.
Absolutely, and I entirely agree with that, and I think it's very insightful. And my theme on that is that we're not particularly a capitalist world at the moment, we're more of a corporatist world, and we've got these vast conglomerates that do a huge range of things, they don't do them particularly well, and it's been propped up by the state via us. Having said that, there's two sides to everything, and the state, and certainly Mr. Osborne and friends, are busy helping these alternative finance providers as a way of diversifying that risk. And I think it's all to play for. I really don't know what it would be looking like in 5 years' time. I can imagine a whole range of things.
To some extent, we feel the same. I mean, I'm very pro-big corporations, but I'm pro-big corporations where they're delivering incredibly good value to the consumer. And I don't believe that the big banking world is delivering good value. And so I'm delighted that government is embracing this new wave of innovation. And certainly the regulation they're bringing to bear would seem to be enormously positive in helping this industry grow.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a really useful note to end up on, Rupert. And I can't give investment advice, otherwise big regulators have come in with beep sticks. So I'm not giving investment advice. But my feeling on the whole sector is it's a great time to look at putting your money in, make your own decisions right now. But I'd certainly be taking it out within 3 or 5 years' time, because just like everything else, which is great value at some point in time, it's cheap. After a while, money flows in and then becomes a bit expensive. Anyway, in the meantime, I think the best way to be measuring your returns is to look at Rupert and AltFi Data's indices. Thank you very much for that, Rupert.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts for new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.